Hey everybody, I'm Ashton Demery.
And I'm Nicole Demery.
And welcome to our Atheist Bible Study.
Where Samuel is no longer alive or relevant to the story, but this chapter is still named after him. That's right, we're starting 2 Samuel.
So we just left off with the death of Saul and all of his sons and really the fall of Israel, sort of, in losing a battle to the Philistines. And we're picking up right where we left off today with David mourning for the loss of Saul and of Jonathan.
Right. So after the battle that takes place where Saul and Jonathan both die, somebody escapes from the camp of Israel and they make their way to David and they report to David that Saul and Jonathan are both dead. And David is like, wait, back up a minute. How do you know that Saul and Jonathan are both dead?
Right.
And the messenger is like, well, I actually killed Saul myself because he asked me to. And David gets super angry at this and gets like all righteous on the guy and is like, how dare you think that you nobody could kill a man chosen by God, even though like he was like super evil and like
right, and he'd been trying to kill David for years.
Yeah,
it was God's will,
yeah,
for him to die.
Yeah,
apparently.
Right, but I guess they just wanted it to be like from the enemy and him for him to die slowly and painfully. Like the fact that this guy basically gave him a mercy killing is like the worst thing.
Right.
Yeah. He gets so angry that he sentences this messenger to death. So he has him executed and then he creates a song about the life and death of Saul and Jonathan.
Which is way too generous to Saul.
Yeah. But my favorite part is at the end, he has this little lyric for Jonathan that says, your love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women.
Yes, I did see that line.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, yeah, the more we like read this, the more it's like, once you start looking at it that way, everything you read after that is very like, it only confirms it.
Yeah. Well, and so we talked about this a lot previously, because like, I really want to read this as like homoerotic. And it is, it definitely is. But also, I think when Ash and I have had conversations about it, like off the podcast, it's homoerotic, but at the same time, it's also that just like the way that hetero relationships today, like relationships between hetero men today are somewhat homoerotic in the sense that men reserve love and respect for other men and sort of, I was going to say not all men again, but that's so stupid. But like, and then, you know, because like most men view women as just like sexual objects. Like, I don't know if you guys saw like the podcast circulating where like these two dudes are talking about how they don't have any friends that are women, like, because they just can't imagine hanging out with a woman if they're not trying to have sex with her.
Right. Yeah. We had just talked about this last night about that is really common for men to not really have female friends. And some men, you know, go as far as to talk openly about like, I wouldn't hang out with a woman ever if I wasn't, you know, interested in having sex with her. And like, you can only imagine that at this time that's got to be all the more extreme, right? Like women probably weren't truly, you know, loved at all by their husbands because.
Oh, and they're definitely not. And like and you can see that in the text because it doesn't matter how the women feel at all. Like, it's never mentioned really how the women feel about their husbands in these. It's only like, Samson loved her, right? But we don't get anything of like her point of view. It's like, right. It's because it doesn't matter. Like, it literally just doesn't matter. That's why they don't put it in.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And then I think also the writers of the book of Samuel seem to admire David for loving Jonathan more than women, right? Mm-hmm. The statement seems to be that his love and respect for Jonathan was so much, right? He had this spiritual connection that was so strong and should be way more important than your relationship with your wife, like that it should be. And he did treat it as more, you know, important than his wife, because to love your wife more than other men is really to put lust and less, mm-hmm, less high-minded things, you know, over,
right,
like spiritual type things, right? That relationship with men is more like in the spirit of God, you know,
right?
Because like, they seem to say,
like, they're the only ones that they see as people,
right?
So they're the only ones that they can truly love, because like, you can't you can't love a woman if you don't even view her as like a person.
Yeah. So going back though, a little bit on this part. So there's a really clear, I think, contradiction here in the story of how Saul dies. So we saw at the end of the last chapter that Saul had been afraid. He wanted his shield bearer to kill him. He asked the boy to kill him, but he was afraid. And so Saul grabbed his own spear and fell on his spear and mm-hmm. killed himself. Whereas in this story, Saul now asks the Amalekite to do it for him, and he does it.
Yeah.
The way that Christians kind of like get around this is, well, like, oh, there's a contradiction, so someone must be lying, and it has to be the Amalekite, because of course an Amalekite would lie, is basically the explanation they give for it, which it's lazy. You know, it's always like, you know, there's no, you know, I can't explain it, so I'll just, you know, there can't be a contradiction, so you just are reading the story wrong. But also, it doesn't make any sense, because basically what they're claiming is that the reason that this all happens is the Amalekite is an opportunist. He comes out in the battle and sees that Saul is dead and sees an opportunity for himself to make money, because he assumes that David hates Saul. He's, I'm going to bring him this, and I'm going to tell him that I killed him, and I'm going to bring him the stuff and, like, you know, praise him, and I'm going to get a bunch of money for this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which doesn't make any sense, because one, he's already got his like armor and stuff, which has got to be incredibly valuable by itself. Why put yourself at risk by going to David? Two, if he really wants money and he thinks that David hates Saul, mm-hmm. why not like claim that he killed him, like just straight up killed him, not that he mercy killed him? And if he's afraid that David's going to kill him for something like that, then he can just say that he saw him die. You know what I mean? Like, why is the Amalekite putting himself in the worst possible situation if he's lying about all of this?
I don't know. Maybe for fame.
But it's not fame. Like, if he get more fame if he actually killed Saul. You know what I mean?
Oh, instead of, like, mercy killing
him? Instead of mercy killing him, right? Like, you get a lot more fame out of that.
I guess, yeah. Honestly, you think that would work either way for that guy, because it's like, he, one, like, yeah, Saul is bad and he was the one to kill him. But also they're kind of saying, like, but David kind of had a relationship with Saul. I mean, that's super weird because Saul was trying to kill David this whole time. But, like, David seems to think that him and Saul were cool.
Yeah.
So, like, the fact that he took him out of his misery, like, should be a positive thing. Like,
right.
I don't know. Really, I feel like this guy, if he's lying about it, it's a pretty solid lie to get you. You know, I feel like it could go either way, but then David is just like, nope, the fact that you killed him is like...
Right, and then ultimately, you know, if he did kill him, he's fulfilling God's, like, promise. So it's just like...
It's actually an excellent lie, if it is a lie.
Yeah, I don't know. It just seems to me like you're having it both ways, and, like, there's no real explanation for what this guy has actually done wrong, other than, like, the best explanation for it is them's just the rules.
Right? Yeah.
Them's just the rules, because David said, you can't touch Saul. No one can touch Saul. Them's the rules. I don't care what he's done. I don't care what God says. If you touch him, you die.
Yeah. And there's a kind of, I feel like there's a lot of that. Like, David has this kind of, like, I don't know, like, I want to say, like, nobility complex. Like, there's a lot of stories where David is like, well, actually, like, you're the bad guy in this situation.
Right. He's like, flips it all around to where, like, any reasonable person would say, like, this is a reasonable response to this. And he's like, no. We, you know, we're too good for that. Except that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, in any other situation, he'll just, like, murder people at random and for no reason.
Yeah. David tries a lot to, like, high road it in this chapter. But then also his version of high roading is then to just kill people who he thinks took the low road.
All right. Well, moving on from that.
So the next thing that happens is David gets anointed king of Judah because Saul is now dead. And David is very happy with the people of Jabesh Gilead because they buried Saul. And David says that this was, like, very good of them and that God will bless them for this.
Right.
So David is now king of Judah. But however, in Israel, where Saul was ruler of, his son has now taken over. So Ishbal is 40 at this time, and now he is king of Israel, while David is still the king of Judah.
And so were you confused when you read this part like I was?
No, actually I wasn't.
Okay, well.
But I should have been, now that you.
So the last chapter we read told of the death of Saul and his sons, right? Which is exactly what God said, right? You and all of your sons are going to die.
Right.
So what it says is that 1 Samuel 31 says, so Saul and his three sons and his armor bearer and all his men died together on the same day. Seems pretty clear to me.
So
that's his three sons, as in the totality of his sons.
Yeah.
Right.
So is Ishbal a bastard?
And then let's go back a little bit to Samuel 14:49. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, Ishvi, and Melchishua. And the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merab, and the name of the younger, Michael.
Oh, who, as like a little reminder, is promised to David.
Correct. So we have an account of who his sons were, right? And then in 1 Samuel 31, the Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, the sons of Saul, which we hadn't noticed before is already a contradiction, because is his son's name Abinadab or Ishvi?
Mm.
Are they both his sons? We understood him to only have three sons.
Right.
And then now we get Ishbal, which nobody knew existed before. And the Christian account of this is not going to be very satisfying to anyone. It's basically that, well, there were more sons. They were just mentioning a couple of his sons.
Mm.
Even though they say the sons of Saul were blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And the three sons of Saul were killed. Right.
Right.
Those are complete statements about, like, those were the sons of Saul.
Yeah.
But because they didn't wrap that around and say, those were the sons of Saul. They were the only sons of Saul. There were not any other sons of Saul. All the sons of Saul were dead.
Yeah.
That was not enough for Christians to understand that as a contradiction.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Also, I think it's interesting here, the name Ishbal is quite clearly, like, you read that and you should know immediately that he's not going to be likable.
Right, because he's got ball in his name.
He's got ball in his name. Writers are trying to tell us that we should associate the negative actions of Ishbal and Ishbal being an unlikable character with the pagan gods.
Yeah. Right?
The gods.
So one day, some of Ishbal's people and some of David's people are hanging around the same pool. And the commanders of Ishbal's people and the commanders of David's people think it would be a fun idea if they have their young men have a little contest. Contest is in air quotes. So basically their idea of a contest and a fun evening is they're going to line up 12 young men from both sides. And then at the same time, they all stab the one across from each other. And that's the contest. Okay, so the next thing that happens is, now that they're all fighting, someone named Asahel.
Job's brother, right?
Yes, who's Job's brother, who's like on David's side, pursues Abner. Abner is the like lead commander for Ishbal. And Abner does not want to kill Asahel because he knows his brother Job. But Asahel doesn't stop pursuing Abner. And so Abner turns around and he puts the butt of his spear through his stomach and back. And so now Asahel's brothers pursue Abner. And then there's kind of like this confrontation once they like back Abner into a corner. But then nothing comes of it. There's like this little confrontation, and then they just go their separate ways.
Right. Well, Abner tells them to, he basically just says, stop.
Yeah.
And so they do. So Abner called to Job, is the sword to keep devouring forever? Do you not know that the end will be bitter? How long will it be before you order your people to turn from the pursuit of their kinsmen? Job says, as God lives, if you had not spoken, the people would have continued to pursue their kinsmen, not stopping until morning. And they left them.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, he kills his brother and then he's about to kill him in revenge. And then Abner says, maybe don't. And he stops.
Yeah. And so then over the years, there's just more of this battling between like Ishbal's people and David's people. And it says like over the years, Saul's house or Ishbal's house becomes weaker and David becomes stronger. Talks about how David has a lot more children. And then we go into this story of Ishbal and Abner, where I guess like one day Ishbal takes notice that Abner has taken one of Saul's concubines for a wife. And he like points this out to Abner, and this greatly upsets Abner. And so he just makes up his mind that now he's going to help David overthrow Ishbal. So Abner contacts David and is like, hey, I would like to be on your side now. Like, I want to help you take down Ishbal. And David agrees to this, but he says that he wants Michal, because Michal is promised to him from that time that he chopped off like 40 Philistine penises and gave them to Saul.
Right.
And I guess he hasn't been married to Michal this whole time, or like she was given to somebody else. And so he wants her back with him. And that's his kind of agreement with Abner. He's like, okay, like you can come to my side as long as you get me Michal.
Right.
And so Abner agrees to this, and he brings Michal with him to go meet David. And the entire time, Michael's husband is following them, and he's crying along the way. Like, he's crying about how Michal is being taken from him. And so like Abner finally gets annoyed and like turns around and is like, you should just go home, dude. And so that's what he does.
Yeah.
He just turns around and goes home.
Abner is probably, he's got to be the most powerful man.
Yeah, what's with his voice?
Like, it's just like, it's a swipe or no swiping power. Yeah, I know. He just says no, and then people listen.
I know.
And they do it. And like, here's the thing, it says like that he walked behind her all the way to Bahurim,
mm-hmm.
right? I don't know the actual distance between these cities. I tried to geographically like work out how far it would be apart, but like, let's say it's like 20 miles.
Yeah.
Like, it takes people like maybe an hour to walk a mile and a half to 2 miles. Like, you're talking about at least a full day of travel by foot before he finally tells him, go home. Wait, he waited that long?
An hour to walk a mile?
Mile and a half to 2 miles, I said. To walk, not run.
Okay. Yeah, I guess. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, you're not going to be pushing it if you got 20 more miles to walk, right?
No, yeah, no, I know. So, it just sounded like a lot. I don't know.
Either way, so, like, let's say if we say it's 20 miles or so, like, it's a day's walk at least before he decides, he waits all day to tell him, why don't you go home?
Right. Yeah. And then he's like, yeah, okay, I guess this is a lost cause. All right. So with that deal completed, Abner starts sort of like rallying the Israel people for David. Then Job, the guy whose brother was killed by Abner, finds out that David is having these like dealings with Abner and that he just let Abner go peacefully. And he doesn't like this because this guy killed his brother. So he invites Abner to chat with him in an alleyway and then stabs him.
Yeah. And like, I mean, it had to have been at least months ago that this battle had taken place. He could have killed him then, but Abner said no. So I guess Abner forgot to tell him stop.
Oh, wait, time. Please don't. Yeah.
Yeah. And they apparently have a limited time period of effect.
Yeah.
Also, why was Abner like, yeah, I'll come into this dark alley.
Oh, yeah, no, I know. It makes no sense. So then we have David again with his like righteous bravado. He's upset that Job has avenged his brother's death by killing Abner. And so he curses Job's family to be leprous, lacking food. He also mentions things like having discharge, spindle, and falls by the sword.
Right.
I don't know what I could guess what discharge, but I don't know what spindle is.
So it doesn't seem like there's a clear answer on what it is, but there's a few different answers. So different translations interpret this as like a cane or something like that to suggest that he's cursing him to always have a cripple in his family.
Mm.
And then other translations suggest that it's suggesting that there will always be somebody in his family who works at the spindle which would imply like poverty.
Okay.
Or it could imply that it will be somebody who's only fit to do a woman's work. So like it's basically saying that he will have like weak sons, like weak or effeminate sons.
Okay. So yeah. So he puts this like terrible curse on Job's family. And then on top of that, he makes everybody mourn Abner's death, which I can't imagine is a very popular decree because like, yeah, Abner like switched sides, but he was still Ishbal's like number one in command, or like, you know, right, like his number two guy. And then David himself does some big dramatic crying over Abner that the people like really respond to and love.
Right. He fasts and weeps and all of this stuff. And then the quote is, so all the people and all Israel understood that day that the king had no part in the killing of Abner, son of Ner.
Yeah.
And that that statement like feels very like, I can just picture these like priests or, you know, people who ultimately work for David, like telling this story to a bunch of little children and like, oh, and of course David had nothing to do with it. Like,
yeah.
And it just feels like a very like, you know, it's propaganda, of course. Like,
yeah, it's just so
it makes me feel like he did have something to do with it.
I know. Well, and because he just continues to have all these big, like over the top displays of like, we shouldn't even kill our enemies. Like, as right, long as they're like, you know, big, important men, then like, nope, nobody should be killing them. Like, that's messed up, guys.
Yeah.
And so this continues when Ishbal is assassinated by some of his own people. Some of his men come to Ishbal while he is sleeping and they kill him and they take his head to David. And when David is approached by these men, he is not happy with their work. And so he has their hands and feet cut off and their bodies hung by a pool in Hebron. And then he takes the time to bury Ishbal's head because it's like important, you know, in the culture to bury the body. So like these men are like dishonored by having their bodies hanging from a tree.
Right.
And he takes the time to bury Ishbal's head.
Right. And I think this all seems really random, but like the common theme to me in all of it is these men that are being killed that he's flipping out over are Israelite men,
mm-hmm,
right? Whereas initially that it was an Amalekite foreigner who came to him originally claiming to have killed Saul, right? That guy's life is meaningless, right? He'll kill him in a second, right? David has been murdering women and children for years, but those were Philistine or they were foreign women and children.
Yeah.
But these are Israelite men. And not only that, they're important Israelite men. Ishbal is an important Israelite man. And so for a couple of random Israelites to kill him is a massive crime.
Right.
So the other thing about this assassination story, the story repeats itself with like two different versions of it. Like it initially says that they walk in, strike him in the stomach, and then make an escape. And then immediately after it says they came in, killed him, beheaded him, and took his head.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know, it's kind of weird and reads weird. They also just sort of drop in the middle of, I mean, not in the middle of the story, but in the backstory, just randomly drop that Jonathan has a crippled son.
Yeah. I feel like they slip that in a few other places too, where it's just like, oh, okay, like we get it, I guess. Like, yeah, thank you for telling us.
Yeah. And it has nothing to do with this story.
No. So now that Ishbal is out of the way, David can finally be king of all of Israel. And so now he is 30, and it says that he ruled Judah for 7 years and 6 months, and he ruled Israel and Judah for 33 years.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And then shortly after this, Jerusalem is made the capital of the United Kingdom, and David has a lot more kids.
So, yeah, in order to take Jerusalem, he has to fight the Jebusites, who in some time span since we last talked about Jerusalem have mm-hmm. taken it over. I assume when the Philistines beat the Israelites, they lost a lot of their territory or something. The response is basically, well, joke's on you because I hate the blind and dumb. And then it says that it became a saying, or that therefore it is said, the blind and the lame shall not come into the house. So from now on,
This is a household saying.
Will not be allowed in the temple is basically what they're saying. They will not allow the blind and the dumb in the temple because David hates them.
All right, so then there's another Philistine attack, which is very easily repulsed, and that's pretty much that.
Yep.
And now that David is settling into being king of all of Israel, he wants to bring the ark to Jerusalem. So they are carrying the ark, him and his army, and they're like dancing and celebrating the whole way, just generally having a really good time partying for the Lord. And the oxen that are carrying the ark, they like shake the cart or something. And so the ark looks unsteady to this guy named Uzzah. And so he puts his hand on it to steady it, which the Lord sees, and then immediately strikes this guy down, which is scary to everybody, but it especially freaks out David, who's now like, okay, so if anybody touches this thing, then, like, God is going to freak out and kill them. Like, maybe we should just leave this.
The giant death box.
Yeah. He's like, maybe I'm having second thoughts about bringing this to Jerusalem.
When, especially, like, I mean, Uzzah is, like, trying, you know, he sees it as a sacred object and doesn't want to see it get dropped on the ground and destroyed.
Right.
And so he tries to protect it, right? And it's another one of those, them's just the rules, right? You don't touch it no matter why.
Right. So they end up leaving the Ark in Obadiah and just moving back to Jerusalem. But then
well, David's kind of like pouting too. Like he like doesn't, he's mad at God for doing it, you know, and just doesn't want anything to do with him for a while.
Yeah. So while the ark is in Obadiah, they are greatly blessed by the Lord, which David catches wind of, and he decides that maybe he does want the ark in Jerusalem because he wants to get in on some of that blessings.
Good luck charm.
Mm-hmm. So then they go back to fetch the ark. And once again, they're doing their whole, like, procession of partying along the way. By the way, the whole time I'm reading this, I'm thinking of Footloose. Because there's just a part in, you know, at the very end of Footloose, where he's making the case that the teenagers should be allowed to dance. Because it's, like, a super religious town, if you guys haven't seen Footloose. and he,
I think everybody's
and
seen
he
Footloose.
And he shares the quote, like, and David danced.
Oh my
David
God.
Danced for the Lord.
Yeah.
So I just thought of that this whole time. Anyways, so you know who isn't a fan of Footloose?
Probably his wife.
Yeah, it's Michael. So Michael, the wife that he paid 40 Philistine penises for.
Yeah. Just the foreskins, not the whole penis.
Sees him from her window dancing with the ark, and she is like, totally aghast at this. And so when David comes home, she's like up and waiting for him and angry and really ready to tell him off.
His dancing must have been really bad.
Well, we're about to find out.
She's disgusted.
We're about to find out a piece of information that isn't explicitly said when we first share about David's dancing. So when David comes through the doors and she's all upset with him, she says, "How the king of Israel honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants' maids, as any vulgar fellow might shamelessly uncover himself." So I interpret that as David is naked, right? Is that
right.
How you read it? Yeah.
Well, so I was very confused by that to begin with, because it said that he was wearing a linen ephod, which implied to me that he was wearing a full, like robe, like, you know, religious garments.
Okay. I don't know. The fact that she uses the word vulgar.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
And uncovering himself, shamelessly uncover himself.
Right, which confused me, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like his penis is just out here flopping in the wind with everybody to see.
Yeah.
And so then David says to Michael, "It was before the Lord who chose me in place of your father and all his household to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, that I have danced before the Lord. I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in my own eyes. But by the maids of whom you have spoken, by them I shall be held in honor."
Yeah.
So he's basically like, look, I'm going to do way nastier shit. I'm going to gross myself out. But these women that you speak of, yeah, they're fucking blessed to see this. Like, it's an honor to see this.
Yeah. So,
which I think is hilarious. This is, I mean, like, this is actually pretty funny, like pretty funny wording for the Bible. It's almost like, you know, when you're reading Shakespeare in high school and you read it and you're like, oh, wait, hold on. Like, wordplay, like, this is fun. Like, Shakespeare is actually funny. That's how I felt reading this.
Yeah. So he also kind of high roads her a little bit, too, it seems like, where he basically says that he's dancing for God. And so, like, you know, he doesn't really care what she thinks. But at the same time, like, he just, like, he didn't want the ark until he found out it was, like, good luck.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he's, like, dancing and raving for God. And he's, like, so about worship all of a sudden.
Well, he was about worship when they were bringing it over to Jerusalem, too. He was dancing then, too.
And apparently not to this level, though. It didn't make it.
Well, not fill Michael, just Michael didn't with see
disgust.
It.
Yeah. So I did some research to try to figure out what exactly people think is going on here and what, like, upsets Michael so much, since it seemed like he was fully clothed based on the description of his outfit. And the most common explanation is that he is simply only wearing the ephod, which is like an apron.
Okay.
So he's basically like bare ass with like the priestly apron on and like nothing else. There's also in other versions of this too, where it's like she almost kind of explicitly compares him to her father and brothers. When she comes at him, she basically says, like, whenever my father would, you know, do worship, you couldn't see any of his skin, but yet you're out here dancing lewdly and like uncovering yourself before all these maids. And so then when he responds that he was chosen over her father, that's like a more direct response to her. And then like what the Christians have to say about this is that like their relationship was just incompatible because David believed in, you know, real worship and Michael just, you know, kind of didn't. You can kind of see like the description of David's dancing here and like why that might be like of that speaks to like a charismatic Protestant mindset of like just absolute like falling over on your face for God or whatever.
Right, people who like to put both hands up in the air.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the punishment, well, it says at the end that then Michael had no children to her dying day, which is sort of like the punishment that she gets for for back-talking David, essentially. Either that or, like, they're saying that, like, their relationship was so bad that they never had sex again.
Right.
But, yeah. Yeah, which is interesting, though, because Michael is the only woman in the Old Testament who is ever quoted to have loved a man. No other woman in the Old Testament ever says that she loved her husband.
She says that she loves her husband?
It says, the Bible says that she did.
Where? No, I know, but where?
It was like back in 1 Samuel, it says that she loved David.
That she loved David?
Yes.
Oh.
And that's the only woman in all of the Old Testament that it ever states loves a man. I think Ruth, it talked about loving
Naomi.
And there's men that are described as loving a woman, mm-hmm. but never the other way around.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. What a turn their relationship took.
I know. Okay. So then David tries to build a house for the ark while it's in Jerusalem. And he's going to like put all these resources into building it a super nice temple. And then God goes on this big rant about how the ark has never been in a temple. It's always been in a tent that was just, you know, pitched. And he doesn't want him to build in any kind of temple or anything like that.
Yeah. And this is also when God gives his like covenant with David, right?
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting the way they describe this. I don't remember exactly what it said for Saul, but it does seem that he's like promising like kind of like forever and ever. And there's no real regard for like whether David has to, you know, do the right things. You know, it's not like the covenant with the Israelites where it's like, if you follow my covenants, it's just like, this is what I'm going to give you, David.
Yeah, like, you're my guy.
Yeah.
You and me forever. Yeah, so then there's a section called David's Prayer, David's Wars, David's Officers. These are just kind of, I mean, I didn't really take notes of anything because there's nothing really of to note.
Yeah, the only segment of that that had anything of interest to me was David's officers. For one, the fact that he makes David, or that he makes Job his general after cursing him and his family. Like he like says that like
Job seems like there's better picks.
Yeah, Job is despicable for what he did to Abner and curse him, but he's my general. And then also it says that David's sons are priests, in addition to Nathan's sons. But David is not, he's not a Levite. He's a Judahite, which violates multiple different, you know, I mean, accounts from the Old Testament, right? In some accounts, you have to be a descendant of Aaron. And in some accounts, you have to be a descendant of Levi, which he's neither.
Yeah. Okay. So then we revisit the fact that David's ex-lover, Joseph, has a...
Jonathan.
Has a crippled son. And his name, we find out his name, because they haven't really been telling us his name. They've just been saying that Jonathan had a crippled son. But his name is Mephibosheth.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just going to...
We'll go with that.
And essentially what happens is David wants to honor Jonathan, and so he ends up giving Mephibosheth all of his father's lands and has him eat dinner with him every night, which I think is more for David than it is for Mephibosheth, and that's just because he's missing Jonathan.
Yeah. On a, like... What does he mean by all that belonged to Saul? Because that like seems like...
That seems like all of Israel. Yeah, I thought the same thing.
That was kind of strange to me, but I guess maybe he just means like sort of his like his specific lands that he had like livestock on and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then the king of the Ammonites dies, and David, as we've seen, is on this whole like you should treat your enemies with kindness, I guess, because they're rich and powerful men, and so they deserve respect. Mm-hmm. So he sends messengers over to give his condolences. And at first, it seems like the prince receives this well until people around him start whispering that they think that David is only trying to spy on him and overthrow him, and that he shouldn't just be so accepting of these messengers, because clearly it's a ploy from David to like undermine him.
Right.
And so Hanun, who's like the king of the, or the son of the king who died, he shaves the messengers' heads and he cuts their robes into like mini skirts and he sends them back.
Doesn't he also shave like half their beards or something like that?
Oh, too? And yeah, I think he shaves their beards too. Yeah. And so this pisses off David. David lets the guys like stay with him until they can grow their hair back and be honorable again. And the Ammonites are like... It's so dumb. It's like, oh, wait, oh, now we're enemies of David? Like, David hates us now? So they start hiring a bunch of armies to go up against them. And, of course, they lose.
Yeah. They get help from the Arameans.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. Yeah, this feels like a definite, like, one of the pretty standard propaganda pieces of the Old Testament of, hey, like, you know, these enemies that we have, well, let me tell you why we are enemies with them. It's because mm-hmm. we showed them kindness. Our king reached out the olive branch to them and they spat in our face.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of people they are.
Yeah.
And that's what you should know about.
But we have always been good people and always the kind of people to...
We never started a war.
No.
No.
All right. So now David's officers are all out fighting and he's all alone by himself in Jerusalem. So he's just enjoying that kingly life. And one morning he wakes up and he goes to his window and he sees a beautiful woman. Sorry. And he sees a beautiful woman bathing down beneath him. And so he inquires about who she is and he learns that she is someone else's wife.
And of course, he's a godly man. So he says, I'm a married man and she's a married woman and I'm never going to talk to her, obviously.
Right. Except that's not what happens. He immediately calls for her. They have sex. Then she goes back home. And then she finds out that she's pregnant. So then she comes back and is like, hey, you got me pregnant.
This is outrageous. Nicole, what's the penalty for adultery in the Old Testament?
What is it? Like kill the woman?
Kill them both.
Get the guy a new wife? Oh, nope. Okay.
Nope, kill them both.
Oh, okay. I was halfway right.
Yeah. It's a good guess, to be fair.
So, this is so great. Okay, so once David finds out that he got this woman pregnant, He summons Uriah, who is her husband.
Yeah, a Hittite.
Uh-huh. And he does everything in his power to get this man to sleep with his wife. So that way they can just set it up as like a, oh, she's pregnant, but it's yours. Like, right. Obviously there was no funny business here. But this man will not do it. He will not go home to see his wife and hang out with her. And so he basically forces David to kill him. But let me back up a little bit.
David really didn't have a choice. I mean.
Yeah. You know, he forced his hand. So when he summons Uriah, Uriah comes and he thinks that he's going to go home to his wife right away because like he's in town and stuff. But instead he chooses to sleep with the rest of the soldiers. And so David asks him about this. He's like, hey, like, why don't you go home to see your wife? And he's like, you know, gives this whole thing about how he's an honorable person and he's going to stay with the rest of the soldiers. So then David tries to get him drunk. So like he'll get drunk and then I guess go home because bang his wife.
Yeah.
But he also doesn't do that. So now David instructs his officers to send Uriah to the front of the lines in the fiercest of battle. And he even like sets it up, like he sets it up very specifically. He wants Uriah in the front of the lines and he wants the men to like pull back a little bit when things get really bad.
Right.
So to guarantee that this guy is going to die. And of course, this works. So David successfully kills. We don't find out her name until later, but her name's Bathsheba.
So we talked about the penalty for adultery. What's the penalty for murder now that he's racked up a second sin?
Yeah, I feel like there has to be also murder.
Yeah, also death.
Yeah.
And also, I didn't, this is a thing I never knew about this story before. And everybody knows the story of Bathsheba.
Mm-hmm.
But it notes also that she was on her period.
Yeah, it does. Because like when she was taking the bath, that's why she was taking the bath, is because she was cleansing herself from her period.
Exactly, yeah. And the penalty for having sex with a woman on her period or during her cleansing period is to be cut off from the people. Both of you shall be cut off from the people.
Right? Yeah.
Which, of course, also didn't happen. I also like how Job uses the whole murdering Uriah thing as like a complete get out of jail free card. So it says basically that Job sends back a messenger and is like, okay, tell David what happened, which is that like, yeah, they won, but like they lost more men than they needed to because their men got taken out by the archers near the wall. And as soon as David starts to like tell you something about, I told Job not to go near the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Tell him that Uriah is dead.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what he does. And David forgets all about any of it. And he says, oh, Uriah's dead. That's wonderful news.
Yeah. I am surprised that we are all so familiar with this story. Because, you know, as we've seen, there's quite a few Bible stories that we like don't really hear or we don't hear the correct version of it, really. Mm-hmm. Like it's kind of twisted around like with Samson. And yeah, I kind of feel like the whole David story was always used as an example of like, all you really need is to like love God, right? And then you can be an asshole. Because yeah. David was an asshole and David is like David is held up as like, he's like the apple of God's eye. Like he is mm-hmm. God's fucking favorite person on this earth. And he did some bad shit.
Yeah. I think, you know, we talked about it a little bit before, like what the stories get told in the Bible are the ones that fit with ideas that Christian churches want to tell. And one of the ideas they really like to tell is the idea of like a flawed, you know, weapon of God, right? Like a flawed hero. And yeah, you know what? Like you can be flawed and also be like used for the good of God. And they do this a lot as like a way of excusing really bad behaviors, right? And we've seen it with like very right-wing Christian politicians such as like Rick Santorum in South Carolina. You see it with like, you know, charismatic televangelists and stuff too, right? Like the flawed but chosen story.
Yeah. Well, and I also feel like it's another story where again, like the woman is depicted as this temptress who leads a good man down the wrong path. Like, mm-hmm. she was just so beautiful. David had to have her. And so he, like, did all these horrible things to get her.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too, is that, like, when I read this story, like, I do think that's a story I was sold as a child, was, like, you know, Bathsheba was sort of a temptress.
Mm-hmm.
But the story I read is a woman's living her life, and a man decides to choose her, and the man is much more powerful, and she really doesn't have any options that, you know, are not going to result in, like, death or damage to her family.
Right.
Also, so I read some things about Bathsheba, and there are some estimates for Bathsheba's age. You want to take a guess at, like, the youngest age in the range that they estimate Bathsheba might have been?
No, is it, like, really young?
It's pretty young.
I'm 12.
Six.
No fucking
that's,
way.
That's the youngest of the
wait,
estimates.
Why are they estimating? I don't understand. So, she's on her period.
Yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I don't know how what the youngest, like, that women, you know, if they start really early can get it. But that's the youngest estimates that some rabbis have given for her age. And, like, there is some basis in terms of, like, some other information that's given later. And we can go into, like, kind of how an estimate gets made once we get to some later chapters here. I just wanted to throw that out there. Like, that those some rabbis estimate her to be as young as, like, 6 years old. But, you know, most of the estimates are certainly not any older than, like, 12.
Jesus. Okay. Cool, I guess. So, Nathan hears about this because the Lord, you know, sees everything, I guess. And so Nathan knows about this.
Yeah.
And so the Lord is displeased with David. And so he sends Nathan to go give David a talking to. So Nathan goes to David and he weaves this whole little story about a poor man and a rich man. Basically, there's a rich man with a very large flock and there's a poor man who has one little lamb that he raised from birth, and he, like, loves this lamb. This lamb is like a daughter to him. And the rich man has a guest over, and he doesn't want to take any lambs from his own flock to feed his guest. And so he takes the poor man's beloved lamb and has it killed. David is enraged by this story. He says that the rich man needs to pay back the poor man, like, fourfold. Yeah, he's just really moved by this story. And then Nathan is like, well, it's you.
You're the man.
You're the man in the story. And your son is going to die.
Yeah.
Because of this. So Bathsheba gives birth to a child. Oh, I think I skipped this part. Basically, so, like, immediately after Uriah dies, they get, and David is like, cool. And he marries Bathsheba.
Right.
And then she has his son.
Yeah.
So now that the Lord has declared the child is going to die, child comes down with a sickness, and David weeps and cries to the Lord for the child to be saved, like, day in and day out.
Mm-hmm.
And then it takes about a week for this illness to finally kill the child. And the servants know before David, and they're talking about it amongst each other. Like, oh, like, I really don't want to tell David. Like, he's going to be so upset by this. Like, he's been crying for days and days. Like, I don't really want to be the one to tell him. And then David walks up and is like, yo, like, what are you guys talking about?
Right.
You guys are, like, whispering over here in the corner. And then he just asks them, like, point blank. So did he die? Is he dead? Is that why you guys are whispering? And they're like, yeah, man, we're so sorry to give you that news. And then it was just like, okay, cool. And then all of them are like, what the hell? Like, this man was, like, so upset. And now he seems totally fine. Like, what's the deal? And David is basically just like, yeah, I mean, I thought there was a chance that if I, like, prayed hard enough that the Lord would save him. But, you know, he's dead now, and there's no reversing that.
It's
so,
like, no crying over spilt milk.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah, so some takeaways I had from this part was in that story of the comparing flock sizes,
mm-hmm.
He says, and it was like a daughter to him.
Yeah.
Right, which is Bathsheba was like a daughter to Uriah.
Right.
So it was pretty creepy.
Yeah.
And then, so, like, you know, we've been talking about the fact that, like, you know, David isn't really getting punished for this, right?
Right.
And, I mean, the Christian explanation for this is why, you know, these laws aren't, like, why they're not applicable to David or whatever is, like, well, like, these are the laws for what the Israelites have to do, right? They have to uphold the laws to the people. It's not like God has to kill them, right? It's God's commandment to the Israelites to kill somebody if they do this among them. And nobody's going to do this to David because he's the king. And who's going to stand witness against David? Which, okay, except that it really doesn't, like, explain how a legal system that is commanded by a supposedly just God can be organized in such a way that your accountability for your actions is inversely proportional to your power.
Right.
And your, like, relevance.
Right. You
know? So there should be, you would think, some response by God to, like, punish you. And we've seen that happen before, right? God does punish people. Abihu and Nadab for bringing their own fire, right? They die on the
spot.
He
only comes down for big stuff, like touching the ark, yeah. It's going to fall on the ground.
Uzzah, Phinehas and Hophni, the sons of Eli, for, you know, getting with ladies outside the temple or whatever. And then, of course, Saul, right? So he does punish people, and he threatens to punish David here, saying he's going to bring up trouble within his own house. And then basically David says he's sorry and seems like he lets him off the hook for that and limits it to, you know, to kill this son.
Yeah, and I think you're supposed to take it as, like, the son dying is, like, the ultimate punishment or whatever, but it seems like David doesn't even take it that way.
Well, no, I mean,
like, because he's not even upset when the kid actually dies.
This is a time period where, like, you'd expect about half of your kids to die.
Right, yeah.
So it's not much of a punishment, really, because then he's going to up and have another kid with Bathsheba, which was, like, his goal in the first place, was to have Bathsheba.
Mm-hmm.
And then either way, like, you know, there's a question of the justice of substitutional punishment, which is what's going on here. And I've seen, like, an account from gotquestions.org where they basically say, well, like, the death of the child is a good thing because they're going to be, you know, embraced in the arms of the Lord, as all the innocents are. But of course, what David did was terrible, because you can't take the potential of a life from a child, because that sounds like abortion. And that's, of course, the greatest evil of all. And it's a horrible theft that David committed.
Yeah.
So at the same time, God, in killing the child, actually did the child a favor. And David, for making God kill the child, has committed a massive theft.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's what you should take away from that. But yeah, so I'm interested to see if there really is more consequences for David from this later, because it did talk about his house kind of falling apart, and I don't know if that still stands to occur or if he got off on that one.
Yeah, and I guess we'll leave you with the fact that the next child that they have together, Bathsheba and David, is Solomon, and Solomon is also God's favorite.
Yeah, which is interesting, because I wouldn't have thought. I know the name Solomon. I don't know a lot from my learning in
he's the baby
Christian
ripper
churches. Oh,
he's the wise king.
Yeah, but I know that he's important, and which is strange, because David has, like, several other wives who are all you would think would be favored above Bathsheba because of the circumstances of Bathsheba.
I know, yeah.
Like, usually, like, your concubines or, like, wives that come around like this are not, like, they're not like the Rachels, you know, where, like,
yeah,
that's, like, your the wife that is chosen for all of your chosen children.
Right. It seems like it should have been Michael, because, like you said, like,
you would think,
she was
yeah.
the one who loved him, and she's a princess.
Yeah,
like,
but
she's
Bathsheba
Saul's
didn't talk back.
Yeah.
She didn't commit nearly the sin that Michael did.
But yeah, I thought that was interesting too, that I didn't realize that Bathsheba was important in the sense that she gives birth to Solomon, who is, like, the next king.
Right. And then also, maybe Solomon's name is also Jedediah. I didn't understand that. Did you get that?
No.
So after it says that he named him Solomon, the Lord loved him and sent a message by the prophet Nathan. So he named him Jedediah because of the Lord.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know which he's named. Is it Jedediah or Solomon?
Both.
Both, I guess.
Both is good.
Guess that's all we have for today. We have any, like, parting thoughts?
Parting thoughts. David is a piece of shit?
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe in the words of Nathan, it's not the size of your flock that matters. It's how you use it.
All right, I'm done. Bye.
All right, bye, y'all.